Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007.
Interviewing Martin Amis tonight is Michael Silverblatt, a man who converses on an equal plane with writers of fiction and nonfiction, as well as poetry, often surprising them with his insights. Michael has made Bookworm the country's premier literary talk show. His secret, says Norman Mailer, who has subjected himself three times to the Bookworm scrutiny, is that he's the best reader in America. Michael's formidable knowledge comes from close reading and analysis of a writer's entire body of work. The late Susan Sontag called him a national treasure. As host and guiding spirit of the half-hour radio show, Michael Silverblatt has reinvented the art of literary conversation, introducing listeners to new and emerging authors, along with writers of the renown. A New York native, Silverblatt graduated from the State University of New York in Buffalo and later took advanced courses at Johns Hopkins. He moved to Los Angeles in the mid-1970s, where he worked in motion picture public relations and script development. He created Bookworm for KCRW-FM in 1989.
I'm very happy to be introducing Martin Amis. We've spoken together, I counted, five times. You know, he's someone who comes from a background that is literary. Both of his parents are novelists, so he comes, in a sense, to the field with a knowledge parental of the battleground. And, you know, in the early books, this House of Meetings, which is published by Knopf, is his 13th novel. His early books presented immediately, I think, an extraordinary challenge to the reader. That is to say, with titles like Dead Babies, which was his second novel, you immediately have to locate yourself with someone who is ferociously funny, who's asking you to laugh at things that you often don't find funny or find painful. And it's been a career in which recognizing the queasiness of certain subjects for humor, materialism, disease, squalid ambition, wrathful sexuality, all of these subjects are treated with a pen that knows the exquisiteness of the English language, so that the beauty of the language runs against the grain of the squalor of the circumstance. In this book, which has been, even by people, it's a very strange thing, even by people who don't seem to like it, they seem to think it's his best. They're willing to concede somehow. He's taken this difficulty a step further. His speaker in the novel, unnamed, is 85 years old. He has endured the front in World War II Germany and 10 years in the Gulag in the Stalinist system. He speaks of himself and his country as essentially unforgivable, and yet his diction contains the accuracies, mordancies, strange to put it, humors of someone who knows that language is both merciless and in its beauties something that might allow us to forgive ourselves, that we can tell stories about ourselves that will allow us to think better of ourselves. He has decided in a book-long letter to a stepdaughter that he is not going to forgive himself, no matter what she may do. And so the language here is language which will not allow him off the hook of a background which he himself regards as despicable. It is a dark book, made darker by the fact that we appreciate the glory of its writing. I think in this regard, I don't know of a book that's taken this particular tightrope walk of the narrator who we find unbearable, whose language rescues him. I don't know of a book that takes it further. It's a truly dark book about our times. This is a man who is now, and here's the kind of humor that occupies this novel, on a guided tour by boat of the gulags. He's returned from his 20 years in America to what he calls the fatherland, and he is now visiting the scenes both of his tortures and of the crimes at his hands perpetrated on others. We're going to talk. In the course of that talk, I'll be asking Martin to read a section of the novel, and then we'll be taking questions from the audience. Welcome, Martin Amis. I think you wanted to...
Oh, yes. Good evening. I've left an icy and wind-lashed London where, in the middle of the week, last week, there was a storm that killed 12 people. Weather deaths, as I call them in my last novel. So it's nice to come to not only temperate, but caring and compassionate Los Angeles. And to see under a sky of faultless azure this evening on the way here, an old guy in a wheelchair crossing the road on an electric wheelchair while being brutally honked at by a Mercedes with tinted windows. That's what I love about Los Angeles, is a town that knows its priorities.
I wanted to begin by asking you to talk about uncomfortable humor and what its function is for you.
It's good to get this out of the way because I've got a feeling that humor isn't going to be around for very much longer. It's very anti-egalitarian, which is the big push, the big force in our society. And Tocqueville saw it coming in America, a century and a half ago, when he said democracy is going to move to such a flaccid, soppy, woozy, onto such a woozy plane that people will be, he said this in 1840 or something, will be terrified of saying anything to anyone because the likelihood of giving offense. Now, a joke, by definition, gives offense. A joke is, by definition, unfair and presupposes superiority. Nietzsche said that a joke is an epigram on the death of a feeling. And think of any sick jokes, and how true that is. But it's also, a joke is a judgment, and society's moving to a place, it seems, at the moment, where it is too anxious about the kind of unease that a joke will cause. And you can even imagine some committee humorlessly deciding that humor has no place among us anymore. So I feel this. I feel that satire is you can be satirical about trivial things, but not about serious things. And to take the obvious example, Swift's Modest Proposal, where he said that the way to solve famine in Ireland was it for them to eat their children. And it was very, very solemnly presented, you know, as if it was a kind of utilitarian solution to the difficulty, and it recognized immediately as satire in the 18th century, but would just make people panic, I think, now.
But there, even in the 18th century, Swift, I think there's some feedback here, but maybe it will fix itself. Swift liked to point out that he had sent out his Tale of a Tub in order to protect Hobbes's Leviathan. He said, I'm writing a book that will disturb people more than the Leviathan in order so that they will take the Leviathan seriously. And I think the humor has that quality as well. It protects the thing that is truly serious. It allows us to get to the heart of things in a darker way.
Oh, it does, and the link between, the bond between humor and common sense is an enormous one. And the Australian writer Clive James defined humor as, he said, humor is common sense dancing. And that's why, I don't know if you know any humorless people, there are certainly some in public life in America, but they shouldn't be, humorless people shouldn't be trusted with anything. I mean, they shouldn't be trusted to get across the road or post a letter or anything at all, because if they don't have that, they don't have common sense either.
Now tell me, do you regard House of Meetings as a satirical novel?
No.
I didn't think so.
No. Satire is being defined as militant irony. It's irony, you know, irony is a famously kind of quietist technique. Satire is irony that wants to actually bring about change, wants to stir things up. Its predecessor, Yellow Dog, is certainly satirical in a way, but this is in fact the most realistic novel I've ever written. It's absolutely 19th century social realist approach, and no messing around with postmodernism or anything like that. It's no unreliable narrators, no, you know, Russian dolls within Russian dolls. It's the straightest novel I've ever written, I think.
Why did you take this on?
The whole thing, or
yes.
Well, you never know why you take on a novel, and it's writing is, I think, a much more physical business than is commonly understood. Everyone thinks it's cerebral and also rational, and you know, the question is always phrased wrong when someone says, "Why did you decide to write about this?" You don't decide to write about write about the subject of your next book. Nabokov described the conception or the accession of a new novel, where he said the first throb of Lolita went through me when etc. And Updike has elaborated that, where he describes such a throb and then says that. That this throb will immediately meet thousands of points of resistance, and that's what you have to get through in the working out of it. But it's taken me many decades to understand this about writing. And in my younger years, if I'd come up against a difficulty in a novel, I would have banged my head against the difficulty, you know, for hours or days until I got past it or didn't or got round it in some way. But now when it happens, I just find myself moving away from my desk and picking up a book and sitting in an easy chair and not worrying about it. And then I don't go back to my desk until my legs sort of take me there and I find I'm back at my desk after a period of not wanting to be at my desk. And that's the body telling you that the unconscious has fixed it and you can now proceed. So it's physical and unconscious, but not much of the rational, not much cogitation goes on. Once you're going, you make 1,000 decisions a page, but the big decisions are all made by the unconscious and by the body, strangely.
It seems to me that in British writing, your father's generation may have been the first to, in a sense, actively welcome and engage attack, that there was a choice of subject that would be likely to outrage the literary public. And I sometimes wondered whether the ferocity of your work, whether you had the strength to face the kinds of responses this work characteristically gets. Because, you know, there are people who read novels and they want to be soulful and they blame the writer for the condition he's writing about rather than their own culture. They want to find the writer to be the perpetrator of an unbearable unkindness, even rudeness, to his own culture. And it seems as if Kingsley Amis was able to stand up to feminists, even people who wanted to regard the artist as an exalted figure. Lucky Jim is anything but exalted. And I wondered if your father's example helped you.
Yes, he says in Lucky Jim, describing a painter, he said he was looking at his best. In fact, to say that he looked like an artist wouldn't have been obviously insulting, he said. There's a big new biography of my father written by a Los Angelian, Zachary Leader, where he speaks in the early pages of comic aggression as being his Kingsley Amis' sort of typical voice. he did write to annoy and took it a bit too far, I think, sometimes. And the phrase I came up to describe it was, it's not épater les bourgeoisie, it's épater les bien passants. The dominant set of values that are, you know, have the approval of the intelligent left. He was always in opposition to that. But my father was, funnily enough, was ideological, and I do think that people divide. They're either ideological or they're not, just as Nabokov thought that people divided into those who slept well and those who didn't. he, of course, was a huge insomniac and had the great line in one of his novels, night is always a giant, but this one was especially terrible. And it used to make him almost black out with irritation when he was in a train and someone would come in and idiotically go to sleep, you know, just like that. But my father was ideological, which is odd because he didn't give a damn what people thought of him socially, but he seemed to need to be a part of some ummah, you know, some common ground. And he was a communist until 1956 with Hungary. And then instead of not being a communist, he became an anti-communist, which is an ideology like any other and leads you into, you know, trouble on the scale of Vietnam, for instance. But I've never felt that. I've never felt that I wanted. I think it's a disgrace to be to connect yourself to an ideology. I think, don't do anything for or with the crowd. And this would include religion too. It's a brotherhood or a sisterhood. It's for people who can't go it alone in some mysterious way, and always violent. For if I may give my theory about why it's always violent, is that an ideology, even one as pallid as what we call political correctness or multiculturalism or relativism, any ideology means taking on a degree of illusion. Religion, we see this very clearly. And once you do that, once you commit yourself to illusion, then it's something that you can't defend with mind alone. So as soon as the ideologue is affronted or challenged, the fists tighten, because you can't do it just with work of mind. So I would resist, to sort of come back towards your question, I would resist any kind of use of what I've got in the interests of some social view or anyway, not in fiction. You can do it in nonfiction. You have your essayistic voice, but fiction should be clear of all that.
Martin Amis, at a certain point, there are writers inevitably we speak of as having had an effect on him. Nabokov is one of them. But a writer who had a personal effect on him was an American, Saul Bellow. And I'm very interested here, because I remember when I was in college and Mr. Samler's Planet came out, there's a scene in which old Mr. Samler is in an elevator and a black man exposes himself. And there's a paragraph-long description of the black man's penis. It aroused huge waves of indignation. That is to say, a subject was being opened in fiction that is supposed to be something that refined people shouldn't be exposed to, our prejudices about the sexuality of of the co-presences in America. And Bellow amazed me by being able really to continue that act of aggression against sensibilities that do not want to be exposed to ideas and perceptions and even images that are opposed to liberal acceptance.
Yeah, I mean, that scene does have a context in that the black man is a very dandified pickpocket, and he works on the bus, and beautifully described the way he works and how he does it. And he turns and sees Samler watching him, and this happens twice. Then he follows him into his apartment building and does this demonstration, as he said. It's a warning. But Saul Bellow, said, I will not deny the evidence of my senses just because they're disapproved of by a certain element. I mean, a very strange thing is happening in England. If I may go on about this for a second. I was away in South America for 2.5 years with a couple of little visits, and when I came back, with a long essay on Islamism that I'd written while in Uruguay. And it shows that it's possible to travel quite a long way while staying still along the political spectrum, because it seemed to me very... reasonable what I'd written, but I was talking about it just before it was published to some friends who said, you do realize that in England now, this was in the summer last year, there are white middle-class demonstrators turning out in great numbers under placards saying, we are all Hezbollah now. This was during the Lebanon-Israel flare-up in the summer. And I said, well, Christ, that my piece is going to seem very right-wing. And in fact, I was accused of neo-imperialism. I can promise you that I didn't get more right-wing while I was in Uruguay. I stayed exactly the same. And then, to show you how far this has got, I was on a program called Question Time, where the audience participates. We were talking about Iraq. It was just after the Baker-Hamilton study group was published. Talking about Iraq, and I was taking what I thought was, you know, boringly centrist line that, you know, clearly what America should have done was finish the job in Afghanistan, tear up the earth looking for Osama bin Laden, let the demographic evidence speak for itself, and that 3 million Afghanis have come back to Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban. Incredible tribute to, you know, that some good has been done. Now it's all precarious because of this awful divagation in Iraq. And they were looking at me with incredulity, the audience. Sort of. And then a woman, her voice trembling with near tearful self-righteousness, said that since it was America that had financed or helped Osama bin Laden while he was pretending to fight the Russians a few years earlier, she said that what America should be doing in response to September the 11th is dropping bombs on themselves, she said. And the audience applauded with enthusiasm. Some very weird things are going on in England. Tremendous anti-Americanism, tremendous anti-Semitism, which is parading as anti-Islamophobia, but a British left-winger, they never look more comfortable when than when they're attacking Israel and delegitimizing Israel. And you can tell that it's anti-Semitism with a clean conscience. And as we were saying earlier, it makes you feel that our species is not a rational species, only fleetingly, evanescently rational. That, you know, just as we're a very violent species, we're not rational species. We love the other stuff.
Yes, I was reading a study of American culture by Grill Marcus recently, and he quoted, of all people, the leader of the band Per Ubu, who said, we have passed the age of enlightenment. We're in the age of superstition and mumbo-jumbo. The world in which reason guides a decision is not the world our children will know. Rationalism will be as mysterious to them as perhaps in the very near future cows will be.
Well, someone said when God dies, when people stop believing in God, which they still show no sign of doing, it's not that people will believe in nothing, and it's not that people will believe quite in everything. It's people will believe in anything. And this does seem to be the case. And, it's consider the stature of the achievement in England with the bien pensant left, that they are of the left, although it insults the left to say it, but they have stupefied by a generation of relativism. They have forced themselves into a position where they are the appeasers and apologists for a creedal wave, Islamism, which is, let's just get it all in, racist, misogynistic, homophobic, totalitarian, inquisitorial, imperialist, and genocidal. That's the one they're backing. You know. And the shape they get themselves into, you know, the contortion they go through to be able to propound this is something to see. And there's the signs of a little backlash and a little movement now to, you know, that that there are worse things on the planet than George Bush. That we're, you know, when civilians die, it's hard to justify this in the context of Iraq, because the legitimacy of the war is so very weak. But when an American kills an Iraqi civilian deliberately, he goes on trial and faces perhaps the death penalty. That's how little we like doing that. And this is not taken on board at all, and lumped in the relativist habit with blowing a bus full of, or a funeral cortege apart. This is all equal. It's as if anything done, sorry to put this brutally, but anything done by people who aren't white has a tremendous moral head start in this way of thinking.
In the book itself, House of Meetings, there's a figure in the book. The narrator has been sent to the gulag. His brother, Lev, arrives there, and Lev announces that he is a pacifist. And his brother, in the section that I'm going to ask Martin to read, is shocked that this pacifist cannot throw someone out of a bunk to take the bunk to sleep on, that he'd rather sleep on the floor. This brother, Lev, says, "By what right would I throw someone out of a bunk?" And his brother, our narrator, says, "The right to live." That is to say that there are occasions in which one is cruel to other people in order to protect oneself. This is one of the debates that run through the center of this very demanding novel. What's thrilling here is that there are no easy answers. In other words, this is not a book that knows how to settle its own hash. It will undo your soul in the process of reading things that are bound to be unpleasant to you and which should be. After all, we are not in a prison camp. This is from chapter 2 of the second part of House of Meetings, a chapter called "Oh, I Can Bear It."
I'd like to remind you that apart from everything else, as you get older, you also get, balder and all the rest of it. You also get blinder. I'm coming to the conclusion that getting old age is like a very irresponsible and, above all, low-budget horror film where they're saving the worst for last. It's a sort of video nasty. And I read the other day about this new mental disease called dysmorphic something syndrome, or perceived ugly syndrome, where you look in the mirror and it's you see something much worse than the reality. And I've decided that that's what I hope I've got. It's like being on LSD every time you look in the mirror. This is a conversation between Lev, who's small and ill-favored and rather yokelish looking and young. He's 19 when he comes to the camp. And his brother, who's 25. And this is post-war, and the great difference between the intellectuals who are imprisoned in the 30s during the terror was that they were intellectuals. The older, the narrator guy, had 4 years on the dirtiest front of the dirtiest fight in history, fighting the Nazis. And the next generation who came after the war were very different and rose up and rebelled. These were veterans. And the narrator says he regards violence as as just a currency in the camps, like tobacco or bread, whereas the younger one is trying to hold on to his integrity because he's just married this woman that they both love. The question is Lev, the younger, the smaller, the weaker, is he going to survive? I told Lev more than once that his chances of survival were reasonably good. That was a guess. Now we can do the math. In the gulag, it was not the case that people died like flies. Rather, flies died like people. Or so it was said in the years before the war, when the camps were lethalized as part of the push of the terror. There were fluctuations, but in general, the death rate was determined by the availability of food. Massively and shamingly, the camp system was a phenomenon of food. In Hungary, 33, one out of seven died. In 1943, one out of five. In 1942, one out of four. By 1948, which is where we are, it had gone back down again, system-wide, and your chances were not much worse than in the rough-and-ready Soviet Union, or the big zoner, as it was universally known in camp. They called the camp the zoner, the 12-time-zone zoner. By 1948, flies had stopped dying like people, and people had gone back to dying like flies. Still, this was the Arctic, and there was the question of his physical mass. What the body is doing in camp is slowly eating itself. My brother was thicker now in the chest and shoulders, but at 5'3", he remained a Lenten meal. An actuary might put it this way. If there were 10 Levs in Norlag in 1948, then one of them was going to die. That still didn't mean that he had a good chance of surviving his 10-year sentence. It meant that he had a good chance of surviving 1948. Do the math, and his prospects were exactly zero. No, less than zero, because it transpired, Venus, this is the stepdaughter that he's addressing all this to, toward the end of the first week, that my brother wasn't merely a fascist, he was also a pacifist. I cannot give here a full inventory of Lev's troubles during his naturalization, and to the extent that I do, it is because everything that happened to him in Norlag came together and converged on the night of July 31st, 1956, in the House of Meetings. This was his Russian cross, but it was also mine. The House of Meetings, by the way, is where they had conjugal visits in the Gulag, if you can believe. Women would travel for months on trucks and trains just to spend one night with their husbands in the Gulag. Almost always a disaster. For the crucial first day of general work, Lev was assigned to, quote, land clearance, unquote, and with a strong brigade, which meant that he was lowered into a pit at 6 a.m, equipped with half a shovel, and hoisted out again 12 hours later. The team got back to the sector just before 8. I scanned their faces. I stared so hard that I felt my eyes might have the power to carve him out of the air. Yes, he was among them, with dropped head, and shoulderless and bow-legged, but he was among them. I knew then that Lev had made the norm, the quota. If he hadn't, they would have left him down there until he had. The team leader, the Latvian, Mark Kagan, would have seen to that. This was a strong brigade. Towards the end of the week, his face wasn't brick red anymore. It was black and blue. "You're a what?" I said. "A pacifist. I didn't want to tell you on the first night." He spat bloodily and wiped his pulp lips. "Non-violence, that's my ticket." "Who did your face?" he said. "There's a Tartar who covets my shovel. He's got the other half of it. I won't fight, but I won't give it up. He's getting the idea. Yesterday he practically bit my hand off at the wrist. Look, I'm 19, it'll heal. And I didn't give it up." "What is all this?" I said. "You can fight. I've seen you. You were even quite talented for a while, after you did Vad, his older brother. And you're stronger now. They had you digging fucking ditches in the street for 4 years. You're no milksop." "I'm not weak anymore, but I'm a pacifist. I turn the other cheek." "Listen," he said, "I'm not Gandhi. I don't believe in heaven. If my life is threatened, I'll fight to defend it, and I think I'd fight to defend yours. I wouldn't be able to help myself. But that's all. I have my reasons. I have my reason. He shook his head, and again he spat. I didn't tell you this either. They killed Solomon Mikolz. Solomon Mikolz was the most famous Jew in Russia, venerable actor, an intercontinental envoy. During the war, he mobilized American Jewry and raised millions of dollars. Once he performed for Joseph Vissarionovich, Stalin, in the Kremlin, Shakespeare, Lear. The organs killed him, road accident. They beat him to death, and then a truck ran over him. It's starting. Zoya, that's his Jewish wife, threw up when she heard. I said, there's nothing you can do about that. What's the Tartar's name? You're not there, you're here. That's right, I'm here. You see, Levitt just told me that after a week in his barracks, one of the most caked and clotted in the whole of Norlak, he was still sleeping on the floor. I feel the need for italicization on the floor. And you just couldn't do that. Down there, you churned in a heap of spongy shit-eaters, decrepit fascists, and old believers inching their way into martyrdom. And the smell, the smell. As the Dark Age Mongol horde approached your city, it hurt the ears when it was still some distance from the walls. More terrifying than the noise was the smell, expressly cultivated, the militarization of dirt, and the breath further enriched by the Mongol diet of fermented mare's milk, horse blood, and other Mongols. So it was in camp, too. The smell was penal, weaponized. The floor of the barracks was where it gathered all the breath of the Zona. Everything comes down on you, he conceded. I reach into my shirt for a handful of lice, and if they're only little ones, I think, fuck it, and put them back. There were about 15 reasons why he couldn't stay down there. He had to make it to the second tier. The topmost boards were, of course, the inalienable roosts of the Urkas. Those are the hereditary criminals who were the kind of elite in the camps. But Lev had to make it to the second tier. So I went through it all again in soft voice earnest. The Latvian will be behind you, I told him. He needs your labor. He needs your sleep, your health. You're not going to last in that brigade, so use the clout now. Gain the phase. For the ground bunk, pick someone who's on the low ration. They won't fight for long. Then trade that for a middle bunk. This time, pick a leech. He'll have greased his way up there. Drag him down. By what right? I suppose that if he ever stopped to think about it, Lev would have found me much reduced humanly. And this is what he suddenly seemed to be doing. To me, by now, violence was a neutral instrument. It wasn't even diplomacy by other means. It was currency, like tobacco, like bread. I told him, by what right? The right to life. They call you a fascist, now act like one. Lev wouldn't do it. He stayed on the floor, and as a result, he was always ill. Pellagra, said Janusz, the young prisoner doctor, and spread his hands. This was a deficiency that announced itself in the form of dermatitis, diarrhea, and disorganization of thought. With hot flushes in the frost of the tundra, with cold sweats in the cauldron of the barracks, and shivering, always shivering, Lev did hard labor in a strong brigade. To one of Conrad's terse characterizations of Russian life, the frequency of the exceptional, I would like to add another, the frequency of the total, total states, with your suffering selected as if off of a menu by your sworn enemy.
I would really like to open what I consider to be the very difficult subject of, see, I have a very funny week. Dave Eggers was here at the beginning of the week, and I was reading his 400-page novel about the Sudanese lost boys, and their lives in America, which in many cases are worse than their lives were in the Sudan. And Norman Mailer's book about Hitler, one of the things we're discovering from our writers is that our complacency and our resistance to things that do not entertain us has to be challenged, but it is very hard to know how to want to read these things. That is to say, there was a point at which I said to others, I do not want to be alive in the world in which these things are happening. So how does one, as a writer, giving this horrible, not necessarily news, but dramatization of what we're trying to refuse to know, how does one allow the reader to want to stay alive afterward?
Oh, I think you have to take that. You can't be worrying about your readers committing suicide. they're more grown up than that. They're big boys and girls now. Anyway, I don't think art has that effect. I don't think it works that way. Otherwise, there would be mass suicides after every performance of King Lear or Othello. In fact, as Aristotle knew, there is another process that takes over, which is called catharsis, where pity and terror are awakened in the recipient of the art, the reader, and are purged, and you come out the other end of it strangely strengthened. I don't blame anyone who doesn't want to think about these things. But to go back to where we began, almost, if you are drawn there, all I felt when I wrote this was I can write a novel about this. Then all discussion is over, really, and that the fact that you can write it overrides anything else. But it's not a simple accounting business of reading about something grim and feeling grim. I think it is like that when it fails. And perhaps you are taking a bit more of a chance writing about the unpleasant. It's actually, what's really difficult is writing about nice things. And I once wrote a friend of my mother said, why don't you write a story about a lovely puppy that comes bounding into a village, and at first they don't like the puppy, but the puppy behaves so well that after a while they all love the puppy. And I did write that story. But it was set in a sort of post-nuclear world. But there was. And the puppy was juxtaposed with the dog, who was this terrible monster that terrorized the village. But the puppy does, in fact, sacrifice himself for the village. So you can play with the sentimental, too. But what is difficult is writing about the nice. And Montalon said that happiness writes white. It's as if the pen, the ink, is white and it doesn't show up on the page. And perhaps, only Tolstoy and, of course, Shakespeare have made happiness, swing on the page. That is the ultimate challenge, writing about nice people. But, I mean, you have what is your key value, and in my case it's... whereas for my father it would have been something like more like decency or doing the right thing, I find myself valuing a kind of passive quality, which is innocence. And there's a sense in which not the narrator, but the hero of this book is Lev, who manages to hang on to that innocence. The whole book is summed up really by a tattoo. The content of a tattoo that was very popular among the Urkas, who were the hereditary criminals, these great circus brutes. who'd be in for knifing a family of six, you know, and were highly privileged by the Bolshevik regime, the socially friendly elements. Didn't do any work. They had the status of trustees. But the most popular Urka tattoo was, you may live, but you won't love. And that is the fate of both the narrator and his innocent little brother. So suggesting that some experiences are so fantastically unjust and degrading that they ruin your capacity for love.
I think we'll try and take a few questions from the audience. There apparently is a microphone making its way down a center aisle, and perhaps some others.
Hello.
Hi.
Should I stand up?
I don't think you have to if you don't want to.
I don't mind. I like your book very much. Thank you for that. I'm Russian. I'm married to an Englishman. My grandparents from both sides have spent 25 years in gulags for coming from very disparate backgrounds. One was Jewish and was propelled to his career because of that. The other one was Russian aristocrat who pledged his allegiance to the state and paid for that. But so I will ask some questions. I just said it in order to explain that I'm somewhat qualified to ask the questions. And you in a way you touched it in what you've said before. You said that you're not ideological. It was one of my questions because the life was so ideological at that time, and the fabric of life was so informed by that. In a way, I had a question why it's not part of the novel, and then I thought that that's the choice you've taken. If I'm speaking too long, please let me know. It's a very long-winded question. I thought that the themes, there are certain themes that interested you, and one of them, I think, life force and different types of men, as in male poets and operators, and which requires brutality to be one. And you sort of put it in a setting of Russia. That's why I didn't see much of ideology. Because ideology, I repeat, was a huge part of life. And do you know what I mean?
Yes, well, it's absolutely taken for granted that they're at the mercy of an ideology taken to insane lengths. And a bigger theme that some other things I've been writing has to do with, and he says that terror and boredom were the two things that they used to run the country. You know, everything was boring. The queuing was boring. The newspapers were boring. Everything on the radio was boring because untrue. Schools were boring. Everything they taught you was lies. You couldn't say what came naturally because you might get denounced. So the area of free discourse vanished. It seems to me that terror and boredom do go together. And have you noticed since September the 11th how world boredom has just with the kind of moral crash that we've had since 2001, this huge resurgence of boredom. And I don't mean airport queues and answering meaningless questions and taking your shoes off, although, you know, it's possible to imagine a future where getting on a bus is going to be like flying El Al. You know, who is your mother's third aunt twice removed. And, but it's more that what we're in now, surprisingly, is this huge confrontation with a dependent mind, the religious mind, the fanatical mind, and it's a kind of leadenness comes over you as you realize this is what the confrontation is, because there can be no discourse or interchange because we share no assumptions. But it's no different really from finding you're about to have dinner alone with a fanatical Christian. All your higher faculties just, you know, switch off. There's nothing for them to do, you know. So it's sort of a death by inanition. And this debate is probably going to go on for a generation. No, that the ideology is completely taken for granted, but the form it takes in the novel is more teasing his young stepdaughter about her ideology. It going without saying, look what ideology can do, you know.
Camp. It was 1936. It's actually a wonderful story. And when she entered, she thought all these people are criminals, and she sat aside because she was here by mistake. She was political. And then someone came up to her and said, "I can smell perfume, so you must be from out. Has Spain been defeated?" That was the first question that she was asked. And those were starving women, all from intellectual sort of privileged background. Anyway, I can go on forever if I feel bad about it. Anyway, my very important question is, do you speak Russian?
No, I've never been to Russia.
Well, you've never been to Russia. No. I'm very impressed because it's unbelievably well researched and very, very accurate. And those are places I know very well. But in a way, I felt that this book could have been written only by an Englishman.
That's why I make him an Anglophile.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I also...
Whose favorite poet is Coleridge. And if we can divide languages by gender, which is sort of a crazy idea, Russian is feminine, although it's a very powerful language.
All countries are he's.
Really?
Yeah.
History. You don't speak Russian.
History would make much more sense if that was the going convention. You say, you know, Russia at this point found his armed forces were, you know, needing, you know. It suddenly makes a lot more sense, this sentimental fiction that we name them after as if they're feminine, you know, they're not.
No.
Thank you.
Next.
New York, I apologize without the mic, but it seems to me, and I'd like you to just discuss this a little bit, that we're sort of caught between not innocence, but blind faith on perhaps the more right-wing ideologues or lack of real ideology, and this sort of cynicism of the left that there's this sort of, oh, they're all bad, like all politicians are bad, and they just dismiss any possibility of coming to another solution. So I'd like you maybe to discuss that. Maybe it's not a right-left thing, but this sort of fight between blind faith and the cynicism of the intellectual.
Yeah, I don't, the left, I think the left is ideological, and it's just an anti-ideology, anti-everything that American government does. That's certainly the sort of Chomsky line. The neocon ideology, I don't really understand it, but it's to do with projecting power and shaping things, is it not? But very much based on the illusion that countries are not just thirsting for democracy, but are ready for democracy. They need secularization more than they need democracy. And It's almost a self-love, thinking that our society is self-evidently so much better, which it is, but that they must love it. And they love it because it's American. There is this sort of funny tautology in American consciousness, you know, the one indispensable nation, good because American, you know. So there is that kind of confusion. But the left, which is all its dreams are completely exploded now and is just defining itself in opposition. But an anti-ideology, an ideology that begins with the word anti, is just as dangerous as we saw with Vietnam, the anti-communist, the domino theory.
One more question. Yes.
How long did you work on this project?
What's the next one? The next one is a blindingly autobiographical novel, where I go back to I wrote a memoir called Experience about my family and my life up to a point. But I want to go back to it as fiction, write about my life, you know, pretty accurately, but to do it within fiction, totally different undertaking. And it's just to give you some idea. It's very as you get older, you want to know where you are in history, not your own contribution, which is infinitesimal, but what you've lived through, what has taken place in your lifetime. You know, I regard myself as a vet of the Cold War, for instance. You know, you are sort of more involved than you think. But the great thing I lived through was feminism. And the title of this novel is The Pregnant Widow. And it's from another Russian thinker, Alexander Herzen, who said, I think very beautifully and hauntingly, he said, when there is a revolution, social, political, or cultural, one should on the whole be braced to be faced with something new and braced by the departure of the old. He said, but what you are left with is not a newborn child, not a new result, a consequence. What you're left with is a pregnant widow, where the father is dead, the child is not yet born, and there will be much trial and tribulation before you hear the baby's cries. Now, I think that feminism is about halfway through its second trimester as we speak. You know, there's this constant illusion that you can decide, for instance, not to be racist. You know, at a snap of a finger, that's all gone, you know. You've got 5 million years of being a racist to get over. You know, that's when we separated from the monkeys. And we're, you know, very enthusiastic racists for the last 5 million years. And the idea that that's going to just flip into non-racism is ridiculous. That's something you hope for your children and for their children. You're working towards that. And the idea that, although it looked that way, was a sort of the sexual revolution was a velvet but not quite a bloodless revolution. But the idea that, you know, after 1970, where Germaine Greer and two other great feminist books came out in that same year, that we'd done it, you know. There was the newborn baby, but it's a long pregnancy and all sorts of other complications are presenting themselves. And the war between the sexes is a cold war, not a hot war, but it's not over. And, you know, I'm a great champion of feminism, but I completely reject the idea that it's a fait accompli.
Thank you very much. Allowed Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles
and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.